Joe?
I think we see, again, the sort of the multi-levelled agreements that are going to be necessary. I mean, when we're talking about a withdrawal agreement, that sort of decision about the continuation of funding from the EU and the conditions that might come with that are going to need to be settled. The current funding period goes up to 2020 as a matter of EU law, and then there's an additional 3 years during which the expenditure has to be sort of finalised. So potentially we're looking up to 2023 for that funding stream, during which time, a usual requirement of EU law around that spending of those monies is that you comply with EU regulations. So whether or not, as part of our withdrawal agreement, if these things are going to sort of flow on for some time before they're finalised, whether or not there are going to be commitments to continued compliance with a host of EU laws, then, you know, that's something else that's sort of locking the UK into the regulations that, for some, was a reason for leaving. So we've got that. But also, of course, we've got what's happening domestically. We've got the, you know, Wales having that debate with UK government about the money, redefinition of the Barnett formula, and where we're looking in the future for that. But of course, when we talk in terms of the amount that Wales is set to lose, what it's also losing is that governance framework, that structure, that tying program, you know, a 7-year program that can sort of look beyond the term of a parliament, and so can sort of see that longer view that might be taken to funding. So there's that that's going to potentially be lost as well.
Ros, I don't know whether this is something on your radar, is it? But can you tell us, what's your take on, you know, agreements that haven't been finalised before the autumn statement?
I would not be betting on obtaining money for those things that have not been finalised before the autumn statement, because it's quite clear less money will be available. That's been stated clearly, less money will be available.
So on that note, we'll go on to another question from the floor. We have one in the front. We have two in the front here, actually. If we can get the mic over to the middle here, to Geraint.
Geraint Arndos, I wonder whether I can just pick up on the legal point. I mean, the repeal of the European Act and the way that impacts in Wales. Do you foresee a real difference between the way that will work out in Wales and the way it will work out in Scotland, given the reserve powers model in Scotland? Is it going to be very easy in Scotland under the reserve powers that, you know, having saved all this stuff, you know, lots of stuff gets transferred automatically? Or are we going to end up in Wales with, you know, a sort of 5-year version of the Wales Bill, sort of bickering over every sort of single piece of European secondary legislation?
Thank you very much. Jo, do you want to...
Just very quickly, in terms of where we're going to be constitutionally, if the new Wales Act is in, then we will have moved to reserved powers, away from a conferred powers, and so...
In a more limited way.
And potentially, whilst some new powers come through the new Wales Act, there is also the potential shutting down of some things as well. If we look at employment protections, the scope for potentially for employment legislation to be taken by the Welsh Assembly that we saw with the Agricultural Wages Bill, the Wages Act, and the movements that are being made to do the same with the trades union legislation, to take a different route from the UK, from London on this, and to recognise, as being said, you know, the stronger social justice model, the better industrial relations that we have in Wales. Now, employment isn't a conferred area, but there's a way of sort of moving round what is conferred, whether that's public services, and trying to get hold of employment that way. Now, there's a suggestion that Wales would have power at the moment to adopt legislation in the employment field through that mechanism, that it would lose under the proposed Wales Bill when it becomes a Wales Act. So if we're looking to the future for the possibility of new approaches to be taken and greater divergence to be taken across the UK, that it's there, in obviously in areas like the environment, where we have sort of clear areas currently conferred or that will not be reserved, and then there's going to be those areas where there's going to be some jockeying for competence there.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but David Melding, the Conservative AM, mentioned that he had some fears about the way powers would be repatriated and whether, even in devolved areas, whether they'd come to Wales or whether they'd be repatriated back to Westminster. Can you explain a bit about that? What, you know, where's it coming from with that?
So what we have, of course, is powers, the competence, the legal power to act, having been shared over the past 40 years between the UK and the European Union. And the majority of areas are areas of shared competence, where the Union legislates and we participate, the UK participates in that legislative process. There are a handful of areas which is exclusively within the remit of the Union to act alone, but by and large, areas are of shared competence. And once the EU has acted, then it has occupied the field. So once it's passed a measure, employment law or environmental law, it's then set the minimum floor there. And then states may be able to go higher, but they can't drop below that minimum floor. Now, across all of these areas of competence, product regulations, competition law, employment law, environmental law, that those competences will be coming back to the UK. But there is a question about, are they going to go back to those devolved administrations? Are they going to go back to the devolved nations where we've seen under the devolution settlements these areas have been devolved, whether that's through a conferral model or a reserved model, that these are within their legal and constitutional heritage to act in these areas. Now, there is an assumption or there's a political statement to be made about they are coming back. However, it's simply not clear whether that's the way it's going to work with the Great Repeal Bill. There may be pressures for re-centralisation in some areas, because what we have to remember is that devolution has been the context in which EU membership has played out, and the EU membership has been the framework for devolution. So the powers that have been devolved, by and large, agriculture, environment, those powers, have been exercised within the framework of EU law. It sets the limits. Now, once you take that away, and once you take that floor away, there is potentially scope for the different devolved nations to go their own way in a more dramatic way, perhaps. But then we have to say, you know, what is feasible, what is practical within the UK. There will be demands for some sort of coming together in some of these areas. It's not just going to be devolution, you know, the exercise of devolved powers for their own sake. We need to sort of have a system for finding the appropriate balance in that. And so some of these things, there may be a reconsideration, because the other big thing is, if you get the devolved responsibility, are you going to get the money to pay for the exercise of that devolved responsibility? Is the capacity there to achieve that? So there are questions about whether we want these things devolved or the terms on which these things are coming back. And so those are questions that are going to be of increasing pertinence as we get closer to that moment of great repeal.
Thanks. Sorry to let you speak at length there, Joe, but I think it was worth getting that analysis. Anybody want to take...
Well, the Wales Bill introduces a great deal of uncertainty into areas that previously were pretty certain because of the change in the way the legislation works from a conferred powers model to a reserve powers model, i.e. instead of saying this is what you're responsible for, under the Wales Bill it says you're responsible for everything but this, and then you have to work out whether that means that you've got exactly the same powers as you had before or whether at the margins it's going to be different. There should be some kind of saving clause in the bill to clarify matters such as, you know, nothing in this bill should limit, restrict or diminish the powers already treated as having been devolved to the Welsh Assembly. And that might help, even if only in terms of construction of the words of legislation as a guide to the courts, to decide whether these devolved powers survive the bill. And in relation to the EU, you make a very important point that so much of the devolution which has already taken place has taking place within a supranational context, not in terms of a UK context. And therefore, it's very easy to devolve matters over which you had no control anyway, even after the decision to devolve was taken. But now this gives Wales, I think, a massive opportunity, is what I've been trying to convince Carvin Jones of, to create a more business-friendly environment within which, you know, we can have a more productive economy in Wales, because if we got responsibility ourselves for things like environmental legislation, health and safety legislation, employment legislation, so on, the power is within our own hands to mould the legislation which applies to businesses in the future in such a way that, you know, you adequately protect employees, but on the, and consumers and the public at large, but on the other hand, you have the opportunity to relate costs and benefits on a much more local basis than we've been able to do in the past. And because the Welsh government is accountable in a way that the EU Commission isn't, democratically, this gives us all collectively much more power to shape the kind of world in which we live here in Wales.
Well, yeah, I'm really a cheerful soul, so I don't know how I ended up in the role of Cassandra here on this panel. But, you know, I mean, we can see how this is going. Just look at the fate of local government in the last 10 years, where they've been left with all the responsibilities and just had all the money taken away. So most of the big squeezes that austerity policy has entailed have fallen on local authorities. And I think it's going to be much easier to give Wales responsibility than it is to give them any money. And so I think the risk here is that the Assembly government will have to do more with less.
Succinct. How does it seem from a Westminster or London-based perspective?
Well, I'm afraid that is pretty much how I see it, because I think they have said quite clearly Wales will get their fair share, but there won't be as big a pot. So you can't make less, you know, into more. That seems to me to be the one of the fundamental problems. And I also want to come back to your point about tariffs, because I was interested in the levels of tariffs that you referred to, and I wonder where these come from.
From the Open Europe website I got those figures.
I mean, are these WTO tariffs? Because there is a major problem in actually using the WTO tariffs from day one. I'm not sure that Open Europe have really addressed that. I mean, my understanding of the tariffs that they cite, I mean, I've heard that figure before, and I accept that that's an average across all the different products that are listed in the WTO schedules, but the trouble is for some of those products, the tariffs are actually very high, if in fact they apply. So if you look at food, I mean, this... not an economist, so I'm only a lawyer, all right? So it may be that there are arguments that economists can bring to bear here which will prove me wrong, but I understand us to import most of our food and to import a lot of it from other parts of the Union. I mean, for example, we're 50% of Ireland's exports, aren't we, for agricultural products. We import a huge amount of food from Ireland. And a lot of that food is food like dairy products, which under the WTO schedules, assuming that somehow you can get them to apply, are subject to rates of between 35 and 48%. I mean, why is this not going to be quite a significant issue on the day that we leave? This is what, I mean, other trade lawyers, specialist trade lawyers, not political people, and I'm not a political person, other trade lawyers also see this as a major problem.
Well, obviously there will be problems of transition, the same way as there were problems of transition when we joined the EEC, as it then was all those years ago. And when the ex-Soviet countries joined the EU, we had a whole range of transitional provisions which applied to them, which meant that the obligations and rights which they subsequently enjoyed in full came into effect at different times according to whatever political problems were thought to need dealing with. And once we are fully in charge of our own trade policy again, of course, it'll be open to us to decide for ourselves what tariffs within the WTO structure we want to apply to other countries. It is true that in certain sectors, particularly the highly regulated, highly protectionist agricultural regime that the CAP constitutes, there are massive tariffs. But we have a massive food trade deficit with the rest of the EU. So again, you know, that's a significant negotiating weapon that we have available to us. It's in everybody's interest to move to free trade. The common agricultural policy has been one of the worst aspects of the European Union, universally almost accepted as such, and it has discriminated against the third world in many, many ways, and it's been a conspiracy against the interests of consumers right from the very start. So
can I bring Rosin? You look a little pained by the answer you're getting there.
Well, I'm not here to defend the CAP, but I do think that, you know, if you look at what the NFU said about coming out of the union, it was clear that the National Farmers Union was against coming out of the union because they feared the loss of food production in this country. And I find these questions... I mean, I am not pretending I know the answer to these questions. I most certainly do not. You know, I am not an economist. I've got a good understanding of trade law, but I am not specialised in every product that's regulated by the WTO. But to me, there is an overriding issue. It's not just about food. It's also about engineering products. It's about automotive products. It's about clothing. Clothing subject to 12% tariffs. You know, some of these tariffs, which affect everybody every day, we all eat food. We all wear clothes. We all, you know, need to inhabit buildings with products, many of which have been imported. My question is, what on earth is going to happen to the rates on these products when we leave the customs union? And I haven't found anybody who's going to answer that for me.
You could take the Patrick Minton view, is that we should follow the Singapore model and just have unilateral free trade, which he argues has been massively in the interests of the Singaporeans. And looking at the figures, it's hard to again say that. But obviously, we operate in a different political context, and therefore that's not going to happen. And so in Wales, you know, the steel industry, for example, and automotive, in terms of agricultural products, you know, we export a huge quantity of lamb to the EU. These are all sectors which are going to require specific negotiation to deal with the outcome. And if we don't manage to negotiate some kind of deal acceptable to both sides, then we will have to cope with the political and economic consequences of that. But, you know, given that we have a massive trade deficit with the EU, if we impose tariffs on their export to us, there is a pot of money which is then going to become available to alleviate the adverse effects which are bound to apply to some industries if we don't have a deal.
Thanks. We'll move on to the next question. I don't know if the mic can come down to the front again.
Thank you, Catherine. Brian Morgan from Cardiff Met University. And with apologies to Eversheds, I'd like to move the debate on from law to economics, although Ross has done a good job of bringing us into that direction anyway. But in terms of economics, I'd like to sort of ask Neil about that figure he quoted at the very beginning, that only 5% of our economy is involved in EU trade. Now, and you said, you know, if we lost half of that, so what? But my reading of the figures is slightly different from that. We're a very open economy in the UK. And if you talk and if you look at all the amount that we export in terms of goods, services and capital, we're a very open economy. It's over 30% of our trade. Now, if we, about half of that is with the EU. Now, if you're losing half of that, it's a huge number. And you're also talking about, as I say, capital investment into this country. And it seems to me that when you're talking about a figure of that size, negotiating a good Brexit is absolutely fundamental. Especially when you're talking, as I say, about future investment into this country.
But why would you assume we'd lose half our trade with the EU? As I said, assuming the figures that I quoted earlier on are correct, that 65% of our trade with the EU will have a maximum tariff of 4% and an average tariff of 2.5%. There will be other sectors like cars, which would have a 10% tariff if we don't come to a deal, and some kinds of steel exports over 20. Maybe true. But why should we assume that even on the worst case scenario that that's going to lead to the loss of half our trade? It just doesn't stack up. The numbers don't fit. The currency movements alone are going to outweigh these kinds of figures and do so on a weekly basis. So we've lost significant amount of value in the internationally traded price of the pound in the last 18 months, and that's been an enormous boost to our trade. So businesses in the real world have to cope with these kinds of swings and roundabouts the whole time, and they don't live in a static universe where nothing changes. If your costs in one area go up, you try to reduce them, or you try to change the way your business operates so that you have more leeway in other respects. There are problems of transition, obviously, going from A to B, but the world is changing the whole time. Nobody lives in a static world, so you're always constantly having to run your business according to changed circumstances.
Jerry, do you want to come on this?
I mean, there will be swings and roundabouts here. You know, those Welsh companies that are selling outside Europe and whose supply chain is entirely domestic will make out like bandits. They'll do extremely well because the pound is down 10% now, and my advice to you is don't bet that it's going back up. So they're all doing very well. But those are the good stories. The trouble is that, you know, on a very large sector like motor cars, as I was saying earlier, the value added that's produced in the UK is only about 30% of the total value. So even a 20% devaluation gives you 6%. That doesn't cope with the 10% tariff. But the real problem isn't the trade. The real problem is that all this stuff is owned by non-British companies. And this is a sector that has massive oversupply around the world. They can make this stuff anywhere. So if you give them a reason to make it somewhere else, why won't they make it somewhere else? I mean, you know, why would Ford have already... This isn't mysterious. Ford have already said they're reducing investment in the engine plant in Bridgend from $200 million to $100 million. Toyota have been moaning about Shotton and the consequences of this. Why do we assume they're bluffing? They don't have to bluff. They've got a plant in Slovakia. They've got a plant in Spain. You make it more expensive to work here, they'll move them there. It's not difficult. So, yes, of course it'll come out in the wash. You know, it'll sort itself out. The world won't end. You're absolutely right. And in 20 years' time, perhaps it'll be all right. But the way it works out, being all right, is the pound goes down, makes everybody poorer. A lot of people get put out of work, and they're all poorer. And in the end, we get so bloody poor that we're so cheap that people move back in and make stuff here. Now, that isn't a very nice way to adjust, but that's the way it works.
But this is nonsense. This is... This is absolute nonsense. I mean, the fact that a currency depreciates doesn't make people poorer. It doesn't. But it makes your goods cheaper. It makes it easier for you to export them.
It makes everything you buy more expensive from abroad.
Of course, 35%
of the consumption basket in this country is imports.
But of course, it affects trade flows. But you've got the certainty that comes from fixed exchange rates within the eurozone. Now that's working out brilliantly, isn't it? This is an opportunity for us, of course. But the reason why the pound is falling is nothing to do with Brexit, really. It's because the government is still spending an amount equivalent to 5% of its GDP every year, which it's simply inventing from nowhere. This government doubled the national debt in 5 years, which was twice and a half times the rate that Gordon Brown doubled the national debt in 13 years of Labour government. So the reason why the pound is going down is because Mugabenomics is the policy of the Conservative government.
It's also the policy of most other governments, and what you've just said is contrary not only to economic theory, it's also contrary to experience. I mean, when Reagan ran a huge deficit, the dollar went up to extremely high levels. I mean,
the dollar is a completely different currency. It's a world reserve currency.
This idea that there's a great opportunity waiting for us, I'd just like to point out that, you know, Germany, which the last time I looked was in the EU, sells five times, not twice as much, not three times as much, five times as much to China as we do. Now, somehow, being in the EU has not impeded them from doing that. If you think we're going to double but quintuple our exports to China in the next 10 years, you're a very optimistic man. And if we succeed, we'll just be there then where Germany is right now. So what is this nonsense about, you know, these great opportunities opening up? The opportunities are there if we could take them right now.
But what has Germany's membership of the EU got to do with its ability to trade with China? I just don't understand.
Well, why are you saying... Because
China doesn't have a trade agreement with the EU.
Apparently our leaving the EU is giving us an opportunity to trade with China, and apparently Germany doesn't require that.
Of course it does. Well, we do trade with China anyway, but what it does do is give us the opportunity to make a trade agreement with China, which we don't have within the EU.
And what are we going to sell them?
Whatever. Whatever we can make and trade competitively.
Right, on that note, I'm afraid we'll have to...
Same as everywhere else in the world, same as every other country in the world does.
On that note, we'll have to draw things to a close. Diolch yn fawr iawn I chi gyd. Thank you all very much. Thanks to our keynote speaker this evening, Ros Calloway. Thanks to Joe Hunter, Neil Hamilton and Jerry Hotham. Thank you for your questions and your comments as well. I'm just going to hand back over to...